My name's Jack Underwood.
And my name's Rachel Allen.
And you're listening to the Faber Poetry Podcast.
Hello, this is Michael Peterson, and I'm sending you a poetry postcard from a wee writer in residence office at Edinburgh University. I've got books bulging out above me, including some from the previous writers that have held this post, going all the way back to Solly MacLean and Norman McCaig, and in more recent years, the likes of Liz Lockhead and Jenny Fagan. So it's a humbling seat to sit in. Anywho, here's the opening poem from my collection, The Cat Prince, drawn from my earliest memories of the type of masculinity that teaches boys to keep things locked away inside. Lines on the Melodies in Men. It is funny, I say to Kay, who's waiting shirtless in the burn, the things we remember about growing. As a boy, I played a game with my uncle, where I blew into his boxer's thumb as he ballooned his muckle bicep, the sugary inkwork of his tattoos smearing to a blur, arms bulging bigger with each puff I stuck him with, stuff solid as he cloud before emptying its storm. I blast another lungful down the thumb's portal, slurp up the tobacco scum, lick my lips like licorice. If they don't give it you, my uncle gruffs, showboating his trophy muscles. Take it with ease. A forced ending. The cloven-hoofed Ars Poetica of Danish Harry, Dad's toughest brother. Popeye arms. I faked coveting them, knowing fine well not even with a marching band would I let that music in. It was the physical play I loved, the luminous swell, like a kissing ritual without the actual kiss. The melodies in men are sometimes my arch nemesis, a neighbour's tusk, the wicked nimbus of a better version gunning for my soft and silly, though mostly their hot courage, brave bones stookied in mucky fun, the buttress of friends hatching body superstanzas. Together, we might lay to rest our uncling's bedraggled sermons. They're just a generational thing, a not-in-our-blood thing. And I do love you, you know that, but for feck's sake, I shouldn't have to broadcast it thing. Just, oh, all the possibilities of a river. In the future, I tell Kay, we will hear each other better. A friend will clasp my hand and beg me be in touch more often, to touch more often. He'll say he's been thinking of me, that he knows is going to hurt hellfire, all the while holding firm as moon grips. Promise, cast not as we splinter into the next stage, but heart beat wet in the here now. Words as close to their import as a sparked match.
That was an audio postcard from Michael Peterson. His most recent collection is The Cat Prince and Other Poems, and his debut novel Muckle Flugger is out in May. Jack, who do we have in the studio today?
Today, Rachel, we're joined by Edwina Attlee and Angie Malenko. Edwina is the author of two pamphlets, Roasting Baby, If a Leaf Falls Press 2016, and The Cream Clinic 2016. She teaches history to students of architecture in London, and her book The Great Shaking was out with Tenement Press this year. Welcome, Edwina.
Thank you.
And we also have Angie Malenko here. Angie Malenko has been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Randall Jarrell Award for Criticism. She writes for the New York Review of Books and the London Review of Books and lives and teaches in Florida. And Edwina, would you like to start by reading a few minutes of poems?
Sure. I'm going to read January and February. January. How wet your trumpets are. Under golden leaves, five little coughs arranged around the forehead like a halo. February. He lifts the axe to chop the wood, prances across the yard. The crows eat up the corn. The baby is back. And the women open their legs to the stove, pushing soft porridge into his mouth like companionable silence. Outside, a thatched fence, beehives topped with snow, smoke pooping from a little chimney into a very bleak sky. Toil in the corner of the Book of Hours includes sewing, small eyes, hard hands made brittle by the hands of the artist, who must know hands. Toil raking the rake through the soil, it too is brittle. I have planted so many seeds, forgot not to work every hour. It was good pushing the seeds down, but now they are uncomfortable and crowded, like the lumpy pillow in the single bed where you sometimes make me sleep and where the mice run scuttle through the walls. This month, I find myself unwittingly open to the church and the field you dragged in. Air like starch under the skirt, your large hands red as dust, your swollen sense of being rightly granted the right to all of us and our hours.
Thank you so much, Edwina. I've been sort of living in this book and reading it and rereading it since I heard you speak from it at the launch, and also we work together on one of your pamphlets, The Cream, maybe 10 years ago now. So it's really special to have you here to talk about this book, which is so extraordinary. And I think as a sort of opening question, because the book's form, the book's thrust, the book's preoccupations and its structure feel like a nice way into thinking about the poems themselves. I wondered if you wanted to talk about how you've chosen to present the book, the ideas around time, the Book of Hours, the seasonal spread that the poems live in, and maybe just a kind of route into the organizing principles that you were engaging in, and how that maps onto maybe the writing of the poems themselves. I'm very interested in the construction of this book, I think.
Yeah, the book is in three parts. The first is called The Book of Days. The second is called Nursery Songs for Impington. And the third is called Archive Songs. And I think only the first section was constructed as a complete sequence. It was written on purpose in that shape and form. The others were more arrived at through a kind of collecting and editing process. But The Book of Days is titled for the medieval projects of Books of Hours. And I was interested in a part of the Book of Hours, which is the labours of the month, which are paintings which show one scene per month throughout the year. And I loved them. I sort of was instantly captured by what they showed, which in the ones I was looking at were either scenes of like peasant life or courtly life, or sometimes both together. But whenever peasant life was shown, it would be in the foreground and there would be the castles in the background. And I guess I'm always looking for something to tell me what to do.
So this is drawn from original medieval books of hours that you looked at and saw.
That's right. So I was looking at each labour of the month in the month I was in.
Yeah.
And trying to write from it during the month and then move on to the next month.
Your own little labour.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're in the book.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. They have these amazing illuminated leaves that... What is that? 1250 or something? Is that
1400?
About much later. Okay,
yeah.
Good. Oh, yeah.
Incredible sort of demarcations of the day, demarcations of the year, that I think about within those kinds of images and also within the book, which are so bound up with care, intellectual care, community care, familial care, parental care.
And obviously the nursery songs for Impington creates also this sense of a childlike grasping towards something like organisation or being held. And something I love so much about your work is the way that you live within the tension of something childlike, a kind of naivety, a cartoonish kind of bubbly language.
Like smoke pooping from a chimney.
Like smoke pooping from a chimney into a bleak sky.
Yeah, yeah. Or like wet trumpets and coughs being arranged. This kind of like, yeah, cartoons is a great kind of noun.
It's my favourite kind of poetry.
Because it's the kind of both the slapstick, but also like the possibility. Mm-hmm. The way in which, you know, anything can be alive.
And the sequencing, you know, when I think about something like something that is comic or comedic in like a very historic sense of the word, it has this sense of timing, it has this sense of pace. And I think I'm thinking around the book in a way without much articulated query. But I think that, I don't know if I can just open that to you and have you continue to talk to us about its construction and its thinking and its generative process.
Yeah, I think with nursery songs, I found a commonality in some of the poems I was writing about being childish. And I was thinking about childish voices and thinking about how that term is often used as a kind of criticism, like stop being so childish. And I guess I'm interested in living in that space. As you say, it's naive, but it's also willful and resistant and kind of wishful as well. And I'm interested in the tension between the things we tell children and the things we tell children not to do, and they seem to be in complete contravention. Like, we lie all the time and we make big fantasies and we're very cruel and, you know, and then the moment we see a child doing these things, we're like, stop that.
Also, they're so much better at sharing than we are, you know, like, I wonder if they're like, if the kind of the pejorative use of childish, obviously, when you're a child, it feels like that because all you want to do is kind of grow up and or like feel kind of grown up. But I think it hides the sort of the scrutiny that we should be placing on like the adult structures. Like, when the only use of like pejorative use of adult is like, I don't even know if it's pejorative, but it's like if it's pornographic or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like that's, but like, no, don't stop being so grown up would be like, I feel like
we should say that.
We should say that more
every
often.
Every single minute of the day.
Yeah, like, because if you just think of like, and all the kind of like awful things that happen in the sort of pantheon of adult behaviours. I hate that phrase, the adult in the room, that I've heard about kind of like a sort of, it's a kind of often real politic pragmatism. You know, like, we can't have a politics that includes morality because that's fanciful.
Mm-hmm.
The adults in the room will remind you that this is the best we're going to get. You know, the sort of like...
Well, the adult's an invented adult, isn't it, almost? It's
A
sort of pseudo-god teacher... scold that we are just creating for ourselves.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of, but it's also like highly limited, habitual, unimaginative, lacks the potential for like, what's the word, transformation. My God, that's really how uncaffeinated I am. that lacks the potential to transform or any kind of like, any of the actual necessary things that we probably need right now. We should all just go around telling people to stop being so bloody grown up and start changing.
Grow down.
But
you know, maybe something that's so incredible about this book, and I can sort of link this to Angie's work as well, when when you come to read, when you're thinking about archives and history and childhood, and I'm thinking about this poem on page 80, I'd thought nursery was a place from history, wolves outside the window, frost on top of the yellow heads in layers. I've seen the records, etc. And I'm interested in this archival inclusion, this historical inclusion into a kind of passageway or a pathway of childhoods, childishness into adulthood. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the importance of what it felt like to mine from a very bureaucratic and administrative kind of space or thinking.
Yeah, I'm researching the history of nurseries in England, and I'm only doing that because I've encountered nurseries with my children. I had only read them in books before, so I kind of access them through fiction and then try to use them and come up against all sorts of things that everyone will be familiar with. But I am looking at the archival records of how people came to think we should have nurseries and then how people tried to get their children into them.
How recent are they? I think I'm going to be shocked here.
Well, they're kind
forever?
Of industrial revolution.
Right.
In terms of organised nurseries that are run by, I guess, people who aren't known to you.
Yeah.
Like childminders have happened forever and ever.
Yeah, yeah. And like the village raising the children, yeah.
I guess part of the inclusion of the archival detail is that I can't let go of them. Like there are some things that you encounter in the archive and you can't let them go. And part of what I want to do is just show them to other people. Like look and look. And I'm interested in what we think we know, like knowledge as something that is adult, and knowledge is something that the child like really wants to have and thinks that once they have it, something will be different. But my experience of learning hasn't quite been like that. Like you kind of learn in circles, and certainly with children, you're encountering a lack of knowledge that is incredible to be near. And maybe the archive's a bit like that too, the sort of something that doesn't add up.
Well, it's a knowledge that you also have to curate and kind of create meaning for yourself, right, within an archive. It's like I'm going to choose how I move through this archive or what's going to speak to me. And, you know, an archive is behind a public collection, perhaps. So there are conversations and interesting maybe tangents around like how we choose to curate knowledges, and when we think about children, the knowledges that we believe they have or don't have. You both have children, so I'm not an expert on if they do actually have a knowledge.
I don't. Yeah, they do, but I wouldn't know. You know, again, like I think the sort of the epistemic puzzle of a child, like is incredible because they know things in. Particularly as soon as they go to school. My daughter knows what happens at school, but that's on a need-to-know basis. She won't tell me. Like, try and get that out of her. It's like a state secret. So, yeah, I mean, but you're also like, what are you thinking? I think, like, I've got an eight-month-old daughter now who's clearly dreaming. She's waking up from dreaming. Like, what does she know about, you know, what do her dreams know of the world? Mm. That's an incredible kind of... And I'll never get close to that. So I think of it, but then that's also like a quandary, isn't it, for all of us, that the knower is always such a feature of the known. I'm always going on about this. The knowledge that exists like some sort of objective rock that in the real world between us, that's a myth. That we're all kind of entering into this.
We're hacky-sacking it around.
Yeah, where it's always a conversation between the archivist and the person having a nose around. And often it's not, the conversation we think we're having is completely different.
Angie, because we're talking about histories and knowledges, I wonder if we could bring you in to perhaps read some pieces, poems.
Sure. Why don't I start with the first poem of Foxglove Wise? It's called Tarpon Springs Epiphany. And it begins with an epigraph by W.H. Auden. every high C accurately struck demolishes the theory that we are the irresponsible puppets of fate or chance. Maria Callas came to our banal climate age 5, wearing her first pair of glasses, so that perhaps the fizz of palms was the first thing to come into focus. In time, she might have seen the crucifix dive at Epiphany, when rain like a jeweler taps gingerly into the crystal of a water crocus. At 5, she was known as Mary Kalogeropoulos, and if I could, I would tell her how my relatives changed their amphibrachic name to Bass, gaining intelligibility despite melismatic loss, the Slavic sonics of affricates and fricatives. They pronounce it like the fish, not the tonal range, alas. But her lossy name provides its own gloss. Let mine underwrite hers like a baseline, as though I had her otherworldly ear. I attended to the Greek boys diving for their cross as a girl released a white dove from the shrine of her consecrated palms. We watched it disappear. If Callas preferred to perform sans lenses, leaving the concert hall a gold vermilion blur, was it to shield her conscience from the world so that she moved and sang in fictive stanzas? Dives and songs that would disclose our nature are from one held breath methodically unfurled. Yes, here's a rump of Poseidon's kingdom. In the gift shops, St. Michael spears the basilisk and Medusa rears her seething skull. Some coral are classified as Gorgonian. Some petrified bodies the treasure hunter's frisk might have been her victims turned to marble. The descendants of those divers will now dive for the crucifix in white tees, fresh from mass, processing barefoot down the main drag behind their priest. A liturgical singer's baritone comes to us live from the bayou's edge, where sacerdotal gulls amass, and the modal melodies strike our ear as from the east. They blessed the boats on Thursday at the docks. By Friday, the wind was high, and late in the night came torrents. To cancel a dive because of showers creates an elemental paradox. But here was the miracle. The rain took flight, the clouds blew off at the behest of unseen powers. Now the procession halted at the bayou, and the priest took over from the singer, though he wasn't singing exactly, but neither did he speak, or rather he spoke in circles, as rhymes do, a sermon on water. That little of its flow was in English, some diverted into Greek, excited me like screams to the angelic orders. For isn't a foreign language the beginning of terror? May I ask the diva if I briefly have her ear? The boys leaped, and in the maelstrom towards the center one surfaced, the cross-bearer. He was borne on shoulders back to the pier, all handsome as cherubs halfway to turning seraphim. The crowd erupted in applause. Meanwhile, the terns, facing the proceedings, crossed their wings behind their backs. Their X'd tips had a darker trim. As a soprano may have colors, our ear discerns when the language disappears in what she sings.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated by this. Is it Terza Rima? I'm trying to track it, but a long distance across the desk here.
Not quite. It's ABC, ABC.
Okay. Yeah. I'm interested in the way that that form was generative in the poem. Because when you have that kind of schema that's kind of turning over, you've got loads going on, these kind of like diving motifs and this strange kind of ceremonial thing happening. How do you... I always think that the hardest thing to do is to adhere to a form and know where you're going, and that basically one of them has to give for it to be good. Like, I'm and like giving up, like allowing the form to produce the idea and following it and kind of getting lost and then pulling it back again. I had a real sense that you were kind of like using and finding the poem through the form this time.
Right, right. I would never say that I knew where I was going beginning with the poem, even though I did, of course, I went to this event and I knew I wanted to write about it, but I didn't know how it was going to, you know, turn out, where it was going to go. And that's where the form does come in. I think, you know, Tom Gunn said it best in an interview where he said that you have to go deeper into your subject if you're going to rhyme. Mm. It forces you to, you know, to depart from your usual cognitive habits and, you know, jump into something new, make that leap. So... and James Merrill also said, rhyme makes you smarter because it makes you think of things you wouldn't have thought before. Mm. So that's my MO, really.
Did you play with a few ways of reproducing this experience, this story before? Or were you really, how did you fall into the sort of commingling of story and form that feels so like tightly put together?
I think what I try to do is I try to start with something almost conversational and then generate the rhyme, like go from part one to part two, where part one is just me talking. And then part two is, okay, I'm going to match what I just said with some rhymes. And that will tell me where to go, you know, tercet by tercet.
Yeah. And you've been... like a little bit accommodating with yourself, like you haven't like tied both hands behind your back because you've got ABC. You've got like two lines
exactly.
Before you've got to come up with something. Yeah, I love that kind of. But that also that is a kind of giving yourself the room to find the rhyme allows you the mind to wander as well, doesn't it? It sort of provokes this kind of, because you can't get to it too soon, you know.
Exactly,
you've got to put some stuff in the way.
Right, right. So often I will do that particular scheme where it's ABC or ABCD, because then there's leeway for something meandering in
it. You're playing with it so much, actually, within this, like the bass, alas, this sort of ABC, like this pronunciation kind of preoccupation, I think, that feels so... playful and funny.
That's how it should be. Yes, I don't do a lot of very straight ahead rhymes. I mean, even like an anagram or a sight rhyme is perfectly acceptable to me.
Yeah, is Muldoon somebody that you like for that? It's sort of, there's a slightly Muldoon-y.
Yeah. It really kind of changed the game for me when I read him, when I read a full book of his. It was Moy, Sand and Gravel.
Oh, yeah.
And I really didn't know why more Americans didn't do this sort of thing. I mean, it just seems like the Irish were having all the fun. So I was decided I would have.
He was huge over here, I think, at that time, actually. And he was producing a book like every year or something, it seemed like. I remember somebody told me once, I shan't say who, because it's quite a funny story. He told me, this was when Muldoon was... when everyone was reading Muldoon, and this influence was very clear, I think, across UK poetry, and in Ireland, obviously. He said, oh, yeah, well, MSG. I was like, what? And he was like, Moy, Sand and Gravel is MSG. I was like, how could it be about monosodium glutamate? And so, but I was like, well, it could be. Paul Muldoon, who knows? Who knows what's going on?
Exactly.
And then I met Paul at a reading maybe like 6 years ago, and I asked him about it, and he was just like, no. Don't know, it's an interesting theory, but it's not one of mine.
You could be lying right now.
What?
This could be, he could have told you that, yeah. That was. And you're guarding the myth of the truth of that book.
Yeah, I'm a keeper of secrets. No, I don't know. I think the hilarious thing, I think, is that like when you once you've introduced these kind of like the possibility that this is actually encryption, then there's this enticing sense. And I think it's always misreading when people think that they've got the key that will crack it, because of course, like, this is like that disavows us from the real thing here, which is the way that form is not a constraint at all. It's a kind of dynamic little vacuum that sort of sucks us, you know? Anyway, sorry.
Encryption is a really nice word, actually, I think, when considering this poem and other works, because there does feel like this sort of adherence to or interest in how we can tell stories in ways that feel like there is a sort of fidelity to poetic form and sort of rhyme schemes and meter and rhythm in a way that I feel quite sort of, you're much better at this, at a way of talking about poetry that is more like...
A bit of prosody.
Yeah,
I mean, I love it, but I mean, I can't, and I sort of feel like sometimes I could do it, sometimes I couldn't. I don't know why I don't, but what I love is when you kind of, when you can see, I encounter, maybe this is what it is, and you, I don't know how you, if this is your experience too, but that sort of like the myth around formalism is that it's this great act of control and mastery, and that when one is using a form, that they're kind of like adherence, this world, it's very sort of like Protestant language. That I think it's like actually this kind of like, there's the kind of more like...
Well, I was thinking about these poems like an unfolding.
Yeah.
Like it felt... There was an idea of form, sometimes like a spectre of form that was being written into. And within those sort of formal particulars, or I guess like hinges, I guess, cornerstones, containers, there is this vast expanse of history and character, public history, personal history, different characters, different lexicons, interests in different languages, artworks. And I almost felt like the gestures towards form was like a wonderful and necessary kind of idea of a container for
That's
these
nice.
Worlds.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
A gravitational like element.
I would say so, yeah. It holds things together, you know, loosely, you know, not in any... I mean, I was surprised to hear you say that here, like, in your culture, it's considered a kind of mastery form, because that's an American... I thought that was an American prejudice.
I think it's more that when... I think free verse is predominant here, but as my sense of the US is, but those who do talk about form and formalism or formalists... I think that, that a lot of the critical discussion around that, or maybe it's when I'm teaching creative writing in particular, maybe it's the rather kind of, maybe it's the high school, the structure. I get lots of, in a poetry exam, for example, there'll be lots of answers which identify the rhyme scheme as a whole thing. And it's always like, that's like looking at a suspension bridge. Like, you're missing the entire point, which is that it gets you from somewhere to somewhere else, and your view along a certain point on that bridge. You know, I think it's the sort of people can see the pattern, the form, but what they don't see, or what people don't tend to talk about, is like what's happening at that one moment when you've had to find something that rhymes with bass, you know.
That's exactly what we should be talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That's the fun part. Is there a bishop-y element as influence here as well?
I should hope so.
Yeah, good. Yeah. This, I think, particularly like a sort of a communal happening. I think I associate that with like bishop.
Oh, that's nice that you say that. Yeah, she's a social poet. You know, you always have the sense that she's talking to someone or she's talking to you. She's not just talking into air and expecting you to eavesdrop on her.
Yeah.
And I certainly identify with that and her her super fan, James Merrill, also did that.
Yeah, he's another poet who you sense if something was going on in the village, he'd want to go and check it out.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he
right.
has a seance practice.
Exactly.
With, you know, he's all the voices.
Exactly. So he's not only talking to humans, he's talking to the dead. And
let's think about how, these talisman relate because... Mm. Ed, you brought something in, and Angie, you haven't for a very good reason.
Right. I couldn't bring my prayer plant with me, but I write next to a prayer plant that will often snap its leaves at me. Mm. It usually happens in the morning or evening when the light is changing and the leaves either snap open or they shut, and it's like the plant is speaking to me or keeping me company. So.
What's it saying? Go to bed. Wake up.
Stop.
Yeah, interesting.
I don't hold on to things very well, so I don't have a talisman because I think that would be really disastrous. But I've bought this small male head cut out of card.
Mm.
I was making... figures out of card for a shadow puppet show, and one of the heads I drew, I didn't realise, but it was on the back of something my children had scribbled over, and they made it so much nicer than I ever could have thought possible. So, I think there is probably some kind of hint there about, you know, cutting stuff out that's already been started by someone else, which I really like to do.
Yeah, I wish my head looked like that.
It's a 70s knitting pattern, so...
Oh.
That's a quiff.
There's a very good head of hair, yeah.
I just meant all the scribbles.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like maybe...
That is what our heads look like.
Yeah, that is this sort of synaptic chaos in there. Yeah, good.
Something else I wanted to talk to you both about is the visual and artworks and thinking through the visual, thinking through image. And I was reading a few... interviews with you, Angie, and in one interview I think you said you would have liked to have been an art critic.
Yeah, I remember saying that.
It's horrible to bring up a previous interview.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, you're on the record of saying
really?
it's when the podcast feels its most kind of like cross-examination-y. Yeah.
You said this
the indicted
in 2019 but I think because there is this wonderful kind of art history in both books, actually, this kind of moving through visual cultures. I hate that phrase, but some kind of image history, hallway of pictures and histories that feel replicated, represented, and worked through in the poems. And I wondered if maybe you could talk about your work's relationship to visual in that way. And take that question however you like. You may want to say, I don't want to be an art critic anymore. Strike that from the record, please.
No, I would love to be an art critic. But I don't live anywhere near art, really, in Florida, where I teach. But I do think that poetry is a thinking through images. I really do. And painting in particular has helped me to think through philosophical questions without devolving into abstractions. So I'm always grounded in, you know, a color or a narrative figure. So, you know, in Foxglove Wise, I talk about the Titian painting Europa because, you know, several of the poems in this book deal with immigration and displacement. And talking about that painting was a way of talking about this immigrant being, you know, being driven to Crete from Phoenicia, for instance.
What is it about sort of, I kind of think paintings when the image is out in the world and it's kind of like there's something analytical and the image is already there. It's not a passivity when to look at a painting. You're highly active, but it's different to sort of like doing the painting in your brain when somebody gives you something, some words, you know, to deal with, and that sort of that imaginative participant. You're almost a bit like the sort of the apprentice of the poet, aren't you? To sort of, can you do this?
Mm.
You know, what do you think that there's something about figuring out? Yeah, I mean, I feel like figuring out it's through images and through metaphors and symbols that I'm able to sort of figure out internally. But I don't think I've ever thought of, it's really struck me actually. I'm thinking about it. That you can look at an image that's already there and that isn't your own, and that can sort of be a space for sort of puzzling something out. Can you talk a bit more about that?
I think it's that, you know, you don't necessarily want to send the reader scurrying to Google or anything, but the fact that you are talking about a common image or an image you can access communally, or that's part of a long conversation we've already been having for hundreds of years.
Mm.
I think that is different, that you're engaging in this pre-existing work, and it's, you know, it's not private.
Mm.
Of course, I make all kinds of private images and so forth in my work, but when you go to a painting, you are, you know, sort of inserting yourself into a conversation.
Mm. It's funny as well, isn't it, though, that, of course, like, the bit of our eye that's in focus is, like, apparently our thumbnail at arm's length. So all our listeners can do that at home. They can extend their arm, and their thumbnail is the bit of their eye that's... So, like, I always think it's, like, fascinating and mean to remind ourselves that we've never actually seen all of our favourite paintings at once. We just move this tiny little speck around it and, like, journeyed it and narrativized it and come up with a whole, unless it's like you observe a tiny painting from across the room, you know, where you can see all of it at once, you know.
But what does it mean to see something all at once? Like,
I don't know. But I think that's probably like a sort of a casual myth.
Yeah.
About,
that's why people revisit the same paintings over and over again. Like, there's the T.J. Clark book where he talks about the activity of what it means to keep revisiting a painting and to have that kind of understanding that the activeness of the painting will also change over time and extend in front of and behind you and your experience of it, which I think when I was thinking about both of your books, this idea of time and history and language, which is wrangled and, like, wrestled so well into different formal states.
Mm.
When I was thinking about something like the gallery space, a curated space, I was sort of thinking about your books in that kind of structural way. And I guess because we are, or there is an idea of writing into or around, about, against paintings. And I guess because, you know, I'm interested in Edwina, you're sort of... how you live with these images now, and are you still writing into them? And maybe when did the first kind of little flurry of response occur?
I think I responded first to the term Book of Hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like, what? What's that? And it is that thing of translating time into words, right? Or time into a page, that seems so neat and achievable in one sense, and of course completely impossible in every other way. So I responded to that term, and then I went to look at them online, public domain reviews, my hot tip. and I suppose I didn't know what I was seeing, and that is very pleasurable, isn't it? When you're looking at something and it's speaking to you, but you don't know what it's saying, like... I know what those forms are, but I don't know what's happening, really. So I would write and write, and then I would stop, and then I would move on to the next month. But I guess I would then carry those images with me. So I think it took about 3 years in total to, like, keep coming back to the month in the month.
Mm.
And I had an idea that I would publish the poems next to the pictures, and I did a reading with the pictures behind me, but people said no, like,
yeah.
it's so distracting and so not what has happened now in the poems. They're not captions of the images. They are responses, or there's something else.
Sort of translations or something.
I think translations.
Time translations as well. And I think when I think about this book, I think about Midwinter Day, probably as its as one of the kin's cousins, sisters of this book. This idea of like, when you read parts of this book feels important to me. And when I think about Midwinter Day, I think about how that book changes over the course of the year and why it feels so significant to read it.
Almanac-y kind of.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
Seasonal time stamping.
Yeah. Her book, Bernadette Meyer's book, Works and Days, was very important to me, which does pass through seasonal time as well.
So that one's probably closer.
I think I just knew it, you know. Yeah. I wasn't as familiar. I'm getting more and more into her. But in that book, it's part diary and part poem, and there's a sort of shuttling between things that have happened and things that she's trying to prompt through writing down little words or making up words, and then poems that sort of stream from that, but they are they're in very different registers. And I loved seeing those together, like that you could have permission to have very different registers in the same book.
Do you think that the illusion is another way to cheat time? Because you're also kind of, you're actually throwing ahead in time the moment when somebody else will look at something that pre-exists the poem.
You're trusting that it will outlive.
Yeah, it's a little throw into the future, isn't it? It's a little casting of the line out, saying you're going to be looking at this picture by so-and-so.
And you're going to see it like this.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to still have the associative capabilities.
It's cheeky.
Once we live on a burned planet full of roaches, maybe.
Like a trap. You're setting a trap.
It is.
I think it is.
Or a gift.
I think it's optimistic. I do. But I always think of Ezra Pound's line that all ages are contemporaneous. And, you know, he wanted to say that, you know, we can read Sappho or we could read Li Po or Petrarch or, you know, that they all exist on a plane together.
Mm. Should we have another poem?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love another poem. Angie, so shall we start with you reading another?
All right. Let's see. Why don't I read one of my Florida poems? This is called Flamboyance. And a flamboyance is a flock of flamingos. The lighthouse fruits like a bromeliad. Its pineapple lens came from Paris. It is named for an evangelist. It stands like a majuscule, clad above the glassy wilderness in an ecstasy of coastal mist. When you go there, don't expect to see the flamingo right away. Sky and bayou, calm as mirrors, hung too high to be checked for your reflection, discouraged display. He wades at the center of rumors, rippling circles, which he flicks, standing on his honor with one foot. He has lost his flamboyance, which is what we call flamingo flocks. Knocked off his migration route by that habitual annoyance, a hurricane or an archangel, he's reconciled to doubt, displaced by several lines of latitude. He should be as easy to spot as a changeling when the tide trickles out. All the heartbreak you've withstood has prepared you for this disappointment. A prescribed burn smolders. You can't tell if it's smoking or misting, the visual field smeared as with ointment. You'll reach for your binoculars to catch fire and water coexisting.
Amazing. I'm like champing at the bit to ask you about weather. I wonder if we want to talk about that now.
Let's talk about it now.
Okay.
Because I think like Florida and weather are like
ecstatic states of meteorological.
And the little bit of the
ephemera.
Sort of precipitousness of your poems as well. That by the end of that poem, it's kind of like. the way you kind of like, yeah, mist and melt things together and keep it, yeah. I mean, foggy's a cliche, isn't it, to say, like, about sort of, but it has that kind of...
Well, that visual field smeared with, as with ointment, this idea of like meteorological texture, a material texture affecting, I think about humidity, you know, and how the atmospheres that we're in affect the way that we're able to be in the world, speak to people, write, etc. And just, I felt with your poems alongside their like linguistic formal preoccupations, there's this like weather that seems to be guiding a lot of what's happening within them.
Is that the Floridian humidity?
Yes, it is. It's Floridian humidity. It's you know, this never quite seeing what you went out to see. So, you know, you literally don't get the flamingo in the poem. You know, the flamingo disappears in this misty marshland. And, you know, it should be the most conspicuous thing around in this landscape, and you can't find it. And that seemed like a metaphor for something. But I wasn't going to pin it down.
No.
The next poem, The Mermaids and Mangroves in Key West, this idea of the, like, commingling of the mythic and the material, this way that I think the histories blend into the contemporary in a like ecological sense, and in a told or received sense. Mm-hmm. I really like that accumulative. I think when I was thinking about your work, I was thinking about the accumulation of sensation.
Yeah, it's hard with Florida because it's such a new place. I mean, it's barely 200 years old in terms of, you know, its real settlement. Mm. Even though actually St. Augustine is the oldest city fort, colonized by Europeans. And that's still there and very interesting place to visit. But there doesn't feel like a lot of history in Florida. And what there is very hardscrabble, it's not monumental, right? Mm. And there's not a lot of culture. It's a place where pioneers came not very long ago. Mm. And even the architecture, there's barely any architecture to speak of. These just one-story cinder block houses. And I tend to do better in places where there is a lot of accumulation. There are a lot of layerings. One of my earlier books was a collection of poems I mostly wrote in Beirut, in the Mediterranean, and where there were archaeological sites that had several layers of civilization beneath them. And so I really thrive on that. So coming to a place where there was hardly anything to work with was a real challenge.
Edwina, would you like to read a poem for us?
Moving, I think, somewhere different. This is a poem written using the National Life Stories Archive at the British Library. It's called You've Got to Turn the Tape Off While I Think. I hurt my leg. I remember sitting on the kitchen table and them sort of scooping it out. Oh, it hurt. Another time, I fell back in the tar bucket, and I can remember standing on the kitchen table and them trying to get it out and soaping me all over. I expect it did come off eventually, but I can't remember it. It was very painful. Not many of us boys ended up with a full set of fingers. In actual fact, my best friend got out of the hospital bed one Sunday as I got into it. He'd lost the tip of his index finger, and I lost the top of my thumb. He was a short man and diabetic, so he had a special diet, butter without salt and the strangest bread. I had a record of refusing to eat what I didn't like, and that didn't work when I went to school. tapioca pudding, which had little hard bits that I couldn't bite through, so I put them like pills around the edge, and she made me swallow them like pills, one at a time, with a glass of water. And then I went and brought them all up on the stairs. My mother always looked like a girl to me, and I can remember this plain as the light of day. She hurt her leg. I can see her now. She stood at the top of the stairs. I remember saying, "I wish grandmother was our mother instead of you. You're only a girl." I remember saying that. She was a little person, but she worked very hard. She used to go for long walks, and she would write to me. That gave me the strength to carry on. You think, well, if I want the lifestyle I have and the money that I have to get on with this. The bed folded back into a sort of cupboard. The mice got into my soap and ate a lot of soap flakes, which I thought was unusual. One day, during an explosion not very far away, an apple came in through an open window, and the book he was reading went out, and a pot of jam in the loft fell down the stairs, and there was jam all over the carpet. 6 years living with my parents before we got the house. You couldn't whip a cat in it, really. I can remember the leaves of trees being totally covered in a film of grit. I was quite good at sharpening pencils. I was a person who kept getting homesick. Up and down, and everyone knowing their place. The baby was born, and only the size of a bag of sugar. I'm not sure she stood a chance. It's only time and knowledge that have proved that what was happening in those days was wrong. He was in bed all the time with pneumonia, so he couldn't go to the funeral. In those days, you could whistle and hum the tunes. At Christmas time, we all went for a drink and sandwiches. There are so many bits of my life that I can't fit in. I don't know which part they've happened in. I should have kept a diary. You've got to turn the tape off while I think. One of my jobs was to make sure the ducks were in at the end of the day. Ducks are funny like that. Wherever they are, they'll sit down. Wherever they are. And there was one particular night when we were playing and we forgot all about the ducks. It caused quite an upheaval. We did find them, quite near to home, sitting down quietly.
Thank you. I mean, talk about time travel. That poem just feels like it bounces me around in a conversation happening through time.
Mm. I find it kind of really moving, actually.
It is really moving. I think something, one of the things I really like about this book is it's kind of like communal hominess, or this kind of coziness that feels like, and I'm going to make this sound really frightening, but like loads and loads of like living rooms or something stacked back to back. This idea that we're watching everybody's small movements towards living, or we're seeing some isolated, and in that isolation, the importance of small acts of being in the moment and in time. That there was something about domesticity that I wanted to maybe just give you as a word, as maybe our like last bit of conversation, like what maybe that word means to the book, or this idea of like small home moments.
Yeah, I think that Gogglebox is actually really interesting to me. I don't watch it, but I'm obsessed with this archive called Mass Observation, where in the 1930s, a poet and a sociologist and anthropologist got together and made their own surveys of people, like the English studying the English. And I feel very close to that thing of looking at people and not being able to know everything about them, but looking at, taking what I can see. So I don't feel like I'm in people's homes, but I am definitely trying to listen to the way they talk and trying to kind of spy on them. But to recognise things, I think. Like, I really, yeah, I think all the things that chime with us do chime across lots of those times and places. And, yeah, so I guess it's
it is cliche. Like, I am really interested in those things that kind of get to us. And she says, doesn't she? She says, plain as the light of day. And like, I love rehearing something cliched in a way that I'm like, oh, that's what that means, or that's what that meant. I kind of hear them differently. Like, rehearing the cliche is really pleasurable for me.
I mean, cliche is so powerful because it's true, isn't it? Like, cliche is just kind of truth.
Yeah, but I think it's been repeated into a sort of generality where you don't even really hear the words anymore.
So then to rehear them.
Yeah, so to sort of suddenly think about, like, like a word, that a phrase that's been repeated into idiom, like that sets my teeth on edge.
Or plain as day.
Light as day, yeah.
Which is amazing, actually.
Mm. Yeah. We should all just give up and just, like, cliches, let them run the world.
Cliches are great.
No, they're not.
They kind of are.
If you pay attention to them, they're okay.
They're fine outside of poems. Don't let that. I'm against this.
Cliches for all.
No.
That's
not the official line of the Faber Poetry Podcast. I'm not encouraging that behaviour.
If you were to talk to my students, they would tell you one of the first things I tell them at the beginning of the semester is no cliches.
Me too, yeah. It's tough. Our job is hard enough without upstarts like you, Rachel Allen.
Build new cliches.
Exactly. Yeah, good. Great.
But you must
know
the cliches that came before you.
Yeah, cliches of the future. Be the cliche you want to see in the world.
Jack!
Sell the poem you want to have the money for in the future. Anyway, I don't know. We're unraveling. That's it now.
We will end here.
Yeah,
I was going to try and end on a cliche, but I can't even think of any. I'm just so original.
Well, at the end of the day.
That was a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's been so lovely to talk to you both. And so excited for your... Is it your first UK publication?
Yes.
So congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
It's really special.
Thank you. I'm thrilled.
Yeah, it's really wonderful to have your work here in this way.
Lovely.
Thank you.
It was great talking to you.
Dear Rachel and Jack, I'm so happy to be sending you this audio postcard from Camberwell in Southeast London. It's my poem Carnelian. And the poem speaks back to one of Arthur Rimbaud's illuminations, but it does so through the prism of a crystal. And in this case, it's a carnelian crystal. So if there was a front of this audio postcard, if there was a front picture, it would be a beautiful orange carnelian crystal. And carnelians... an incredibly beautiful mineral or crystal, and it has lots of different gradations of orange, and you can see lots of strata and fissures in it. Carnelian. Between the scrubland and forest, living orange and lotus, a carnelian-lipped lad is meditating, bringing all this into being. His third eye, vibrational, humming, is a raw form carnelian. Even his apricot body, life force, seems hewn out of carnelian. Bronze light edges across the treetops, sharpening, clarifying. An ornamental koi has swallowed the sun. This carnelian of him, peerless, precious enough for a diadem or the cover of some illuminated manuscript, stores the knowledge, a hardened by earth drive, of all of us faceted, hammered into and glints. Dearest heart, cut out and shining, but you cannot be broken even by this sheer terribleness. Dearest body, where is my body? I am entombed in this carnelian mind, beveled and tumbled synapses, peachy pink shrieks. Dearest mind, is ennui a singular type of PTSD? The listless jeweler spots a flaw in the carnelian and gets polishing, smoothing down the filigree, igneous bubbling of overripe orange and glittering stone flesh, artificer knuckle deep in pyroclastic shards. The world seems amber tinted, rusty throb.
We got a dear Rachel and Jack. That's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
To have a postcard. I felt like Richard really, he totally understood the assignment, as the Gen Z say these days. He actually sent us a postcard. But with this picture of the carnelian orange gemstone on it, I loved how the poem, it's this meditational, this figure, this kind of orange guy with his carnelian third eye.
Who is also being written to, as we are being written to, almost, because the address of the poem is towards the carnelian boy.
Yeah.
Alongside the mind and the body.
And it's this kind of, in that meditational state where things are kind of disappearing or merging, this kind of borderline, this sort of rusty throb, he said. I love the kind of blurring, like, where are you in the end of the poem? And I really, I love that kind of, and maybe like the epistolic dear as well. Like, once you're sort of disembodied through meditation or even reading a poem, like, where are you? And you're sort of writing from that place. This is a postcard within a postcard.
Yeah, and I like the idea that this mineral matter is the vibrational force and, like, spiritual force and mystical force and, like, material force in the poem that seems that the poem seems to, like, accumulate around, or like how sort of moss does on a stone. Like, it kind of gathers around the carnelian crystal, this meaning of dear body, dear mind, and the metaphor of the crystal as the boy in the poem who has obviously experienced, as the poem states, some kind of traumatic event that is now being cycled through, lived through, looked through, as you would kind of handle
the stone. Yeah, this kind of disassociated aftermath. Yeah. Dearest body, where is my body? I loved that moment.
And the reverberating repetitions of the orange, I found really kaleidoscopic, really hallucinogenic, actually. And when you think about a crystal's property, and Richard mentioned at the beginning the kind of strata of the crystal, and you think about, and he mentioned the gradations, I think, or the gradations of colour, the sort of levels of colour, the kind of like ledges of density within a crystal. There's this idea of like power and strength, like how the different colour can communicate a different level of strength. So there's so much kind of packed, not only into the crystal it's being written about, but the poem that is also about the crystal, which is also about a human body. So it feels like this really peely, peely poem.
He's an apricot at one point as well, isn't he? This kind of apricot guy. Yeah. Do you know what? When he said that there's this sort of, the carnelian has like fissures in it, I heard fissures.
Fissures in it.
But then the poem did have a carp in it.
It's multi-materialed.
Yeah.
I think.
That's not an important point. It's a misreading of the poem. But sometimes those things happen.
That's so important.
The mishearings.
Because also it's not actually a mishearing, probably, because I think a poet will know how something could also be misread, what it would sound like. Fishers sounds like fishes.
Yeah.
And we will have an awareness of that. Even if it's not an intentional placing, there will be a knowledge that there's a closeness between those two words, which will be, so you're not mishearing, you're probably really hearing.
I agree.
You're hearing very closely.
Very closely. Do you think that we're kind of really are in this kind of like very oranging, like the whole sort of world has kind of been oranged, and we've kind of lost ourselves in our kind of usual embodied, bordered, aspect on things. I didn't pick up on the sort of like traumatic aftermath thing.
I think it was only because there's a moment in the poem where there's a very clear mention of PTSD.
Oh, yeah.
And that, I think, within the kind of illusory space and the kind of otherworldly space that was being built, it was like the rock dropped or something. Like, it really, the poem like thudded to a reality there that then coloured the rest of the work that was happening. And maybe that is intentional on Rich's part, maybe it's not, but it was definitely a kind of... I like this poem because of its hardness and its softness and the way it moves between hard states of matter and softer states of matter. And that, to me, felt like a sort of intriguing word because it's hard and it's soft and it's kind of clinical, but it's not, it's therapeutic. And there's a lot, I think, about therapy and material and colour that feels not overwhelming, but kind of like it's... I don't know. I don't know how to describe it.
Do you know, I think like when I think about like trying to like be thoughtless, I don't mean like careless, I mean thought without thought. Sometimes colour is a good place to go, isn't it? Like to think on like orange, you can kind of lose your thoughts. You can sort
orange
of...
Orange is actually my favourite colour.
Is it?
Yeah.
Have you ever been bathed in orange light, like fully bathed in it?
I don't know.
I think that would be nice. I think you'd feel like a delicious Barocca
descending into the... More colours do feel fizzing up in the grey light of a
hangover. Into a warm
Barocca
glass.
Feels like a hangover thing to me, though.
Really?
Yeah.
You probably eat more vegetables
than cozy.
I do. Anyway, yes, sorry. I think that the way that this poem kind of... I don't think it ever effervesces... but I think it does like throb. I think it kind of like that kind of Rothko-y kind of like...
Oh, yeah.
I feel like this is a kind of a bathing in light and...
Starts in a forest as well, right?
Yeah.
Which is so intriguing because you move from this totally green... When if somebody says something like forest or tree at the beginning of a poem, you're like green, you're bathed in green. So then we almost have like a colour gradient that shifts from orange.
And that poem is from Richard's second collection, That Broke Into Shining Crystals, which will be published by Faber. And to finish the episode, we have an audio postcard from Diane Zeuss, whose collections Frank and Modern Poetry are published by Fitzcarraldo.
Romantic poet. You would not have loved him, my friend, the scholar, decried. He brushed his teeth, if at all, with salt. He lied and rarely washed his hair. Wiped his ass with leaves or with his hand. The top of his head would have barely reached your tits. His pits reeked, as did his deathbed. But the nightingale, I said.
That was the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Rachel Allen and Jack Underwood and produced by Hannah Marshall, Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen for Faber and Faber.
You can listen to our podcast on your favourite audio platform. And don't forget to subscribe, rate and tell your friends about our show.